You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 14th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Michelle Chen on who exactly is most hurt by the Supreme Court's latest attack on labor. Also on the program today, more on the humanitarian crisis that is at our border. Meanwhile, Israel continues its assault on Gaza. Now, hundreds killed. The majority are civilians, and nearly half of those civilians are children. Also on the program today, what's the matter with Kansas? I'll finally tell you. And we're going to start to underfund pensions even longer so that everyone can pretend they are fiscally disciplined. For whatever that means. In Florida, a congressional map redrawn by Republicans is found to be illegal. And, that and more fun hijinks today on the program. Just a programming note, ladies and gentlemen. Matt and Mike will be here on Wednesday to do their Matt and Michael Mondays show. And I will be headed to Detroit for the Netroots Nation festivities. I will be broadcasting live from there, and always fun. Hopefully we'll get a lot of interviews. If you have any requests, by all means, send them to me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Also, another note, I think by now most of you know the 3 to 6 show is over. Maybe you're already sensing a little bit more rest in my voice. Feel badly about it, and hopefully some of you folks who enjoyed that program have decided to tune into the Majority Report. I'm not going to get into it too much, although if people ask me questions about it on IM in the members' half of the program, I happily will answer. I think we've talked about it quite a bit. Just in preface of heading to Netroots Nation, activists are already beginning to block trucks that trucks and I guess just officials who are heading to turn off the water for tens of thousands of customers across the city who are behind on their water payments. Detroit is one of the most expensive cities in the country for water services, largely because there are so many people who cannot pay. Has a poverty rate of 44%, And members of the Detroit Water Brigade are already trying direct action to stop these water shutoffs. Remember, and I think I spoke about this, and you'll have to forgive me for the next week or so, I will still be confused as to what I've addressed on various shows. But there's hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, that have not been paid by corporations and large entities that still in arrears. Unclear whether or not they're going to have their water shut off. But earlier this last week, a group from Windsor, Ontario, that's in Canada, crossed the border to deliver 1,000 liters of water in support of Detroit residents. No word as to whether or not any of the morons in the nativist part of the Republican Party, somewhere probably around 60%, maybe 70, are protesting the water that's coming in because it's not pure American bodily fluids. But we will continue to update you on that story. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Michelle Chen. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. We tried to play some Ramones in honor of the passing of Tommy Ramone this past week. It didn't work out. I'm not sure why. But on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program contributing writer to The Nation magazine, contributing editor to In These Times, and co-host of the podcast Belabored, Michelle Chen. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Hi.
So, Michelle, let's talk about we've covered, quite a bit, the Harris v. Quinn ruling that the Supreme Court handed down last week, or I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, which involved the question as to whether or not a fair share fees, the fees that union members are required to pay, or I should say the fees that people who work in more or less a union shop, whether or not they're members of a union, are required to pay just for the expenses of the union negotiating their contract. And we've spoken about how the Supreme Court is en route to determining this for a broader class of people, but this was specifically for a specific subset of union members who the Supreme Court has now deemed, public union members, who the Supreme Court has now deemed are not eligible. Just tell us about the general subset, and then we'll talk about who exactly these folks are.
Right. Well, the case basically took on a Supreme Court precedent called Abood versus Detroit Department of Education. And it's a 40-year-old precedent that basically says it mandates it mandates fair share for public sector unions because they say that just like workers in the private sector, if they're represented by a union that's collectively bargaining on their behalf, then, you know, it's their duty. It's their fair share to basically pay for the maintenance of that union, of that organizational structure. So the subset is public sector workers. So these are people like, you know, teachers, cops, firefighters, things like that. But the Supreme Court really zeroed in on a subset of a subset of these unionized workers, and they basically looked at home health care aides in Illinois. So a subset of a subset of a subset, if you will. But in Illinois, there is a group of a rather large group, tens of thousands actually, of home health care providers who basically act as health aides for people with disabilities. So they care for them in their home, and it's a system that was set up as sort of a way to merge the idea of community-based personalized care for people with disabilities and the idea of like a Medicaid-funded public structure for providing health care. And the point was basically to sort of deinstitutionalize care for people with disabilities. And so these home health aides, they have been doing this work for many, many years. And it was about 10 years ago that they got a union finally. And since then, SEIU has managed to collectively bargain on behalf of home care workers across the state, and that's led to substantial gains in terms of wages, benefits, training, and such. So this case was then brought by, ostensibly the plaintiffs were a group of workers within that subset who objected to the idea of fair share, right? So they personally rejected, they're part of a group that voted against unionization, and they thought, you know, look, this is not fair. We're personally not in favor of a union. Why should we have to pay these fees, right? And what happened was they sort of used that argument became sort of a cudgel for the right to work movement, which I think you've probably talked about in your show quite a bit in terms of just this movement around the country that has been trying to overturn things like fair share and undermine union rights across the country. And so they look for every single sort of loophole in the law that they can exploit. And so they took this case to the Supreme Court, and they basically said, look, you know, these workers are being treated unfairly. It's what they call forced unionization, as if like someone's holding a gun to their head and saying, you must pay dues to this evil union. And that's how it wound up at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court basically ruled that you know, the workers had a right to not pay. And that is essentially kind of unraveling this collective bargaining structure, or threatens to unravel this collective bargaining structure. In my article, I talked about why this is particularly relevant for the group of workers at the center of this case, because they aren't just regular public sector workers. They are particularly precarious and sort of unique set of public sector workers who work in the field of care.
Now Michelle, let me just clarify one thing. The ruling held that ultimately they were not required to pay fair share fees because the court didn't ultimately consider them public workers. Is that right or no?
Yeah, I mean, they created sort of a carve-out. So Samuel Alito, in this rather unique phraseology, came up with the term partial public employee. So basically they said they're not really public sector employees, so that earlier precedent doesn't really apply to this group of workers. And the justification he used was what I was getting at earlier, which was that these are workers who work in the private homes of individuals, and so they're much more like private sector workers than ordinary, say, like people working in, you know, I don't know, like, you know, collecting tolls at a toll booth or meat inspection or something like that. So essentially, he's saying these are kind of quasi-public workers. And so by creating this carve-out, they basically undermine the precedent for these home care workers. And what this does to this group of workers is it takes a sector that has been historically very precarious, really low wage, extremely arduous working conditions, often exploitative, and it's going to impact disproportionately women and women of color, especially. These are jobs that have historically been done by women of color and immigrants, and that's been consistent, you know, for well over a century now. And those are the groups of workers that are potentially affected by this. And you know, I argue that union rights are, you know, the fact that they're being carved out really shows just how marginal they are in the workforce. And even though they had this union, right, it's now come under attack from the highest court in the land. And you still see this persistent kind of ideological thread saying that they don't count because they're doing women's work.
Yeah, and I want to get to that angle of it, and just so that people are clear, the deal was struck between the SEIU and the state of Illinois because these workers are being paid out of Medicaid funds, which of course are public sector funds, and so what. What happens now? I mean, so you have the opportunity for these workers to essentially opt out for paying their fair share of the fees that are involved specifically in the negotiation and the development of these contracts, and I would also imagine sort of the oversight in making sure that. People are getting paid what they're supposed to, that the working conditions are up to a specific standard. So how is the union reacting to this? I mean, do we know? Has there been enough time yet?
Well, from what I understand, and I've done a little poking around in terms of what people in the labor movement have been saying, and also some scholars who study this stuff. I mean, they say that it wasn't as big a blow as it could have been for a couple reasons. First of all, it only affects, you know, one, as we said, one portion of the public sector. So their, you know, fair share still applies to many other public sector unions out there. But another thing is that people think that this is going to be sort of a good, you know, kick in the behind for the labor movement, that it might actually re-energize some of those organizing efforts and perhaps goad established unions into not taking their dues-paying workers for granted. So they're saying maybe this will revitalize organizing efforts at the grassroots level, and so they'll start to undertake, you know, really intense membership drives. I mean, that's one possible reaction. Unions could say, look, now that workers are no longer mandated, right, to pay for the maintenance of the union, we have to sell ourselves, essentially. We have to market ourselves. We have to give them more of an offering in terms of what we do to represent them. And so this might mean, you know, making stronger collective bargaining demands, you know, representing them politically in another way, using their union apparatus to do more political mobilizing and rally people around a cause, or even just doing membership drives themselves. I mean, SEIU, you know, since this ruling was handed down, they've continued with their organizing efforts. I think they are currently in the process of organizing a home care workers union in Minnesota. And, you know, the workers there, they're like, you know, yeah, this is a setback sort of on the legal kind of theoretical level, but we're just going to keep on plowing ahead. And so they're reaching out to more workers and they're trying to make the case for, you know, why you should pay your dues voluntarily.
And there seems to me, at least from a very sort of practical standpoint, a fairly good argument when you look at the difference it's meant just in terms of pay. Walk us through those numbers and give us a sense too of what the other implications are in terms of working conditions. And I know there was also a sense that having a union basically provided, in all that entails, provided a sense that people, and like you, and the point of your piece that the women who are in this profession are in fact in a profession.
Yeah, definitely. Just in general, looking at the way women benefit from unions, there have been a couple of reports that I cite in the article. One is from Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Economic Policy Institute have both done studies on this, but they've shown that there's actually a pretty significant union advantage, and it is unique. And, you know, there's a union advantage generally for workers, right? If you're part of a union, you're more likely to have better wages and benefits, period. But for women especially, you know, it's they might earn, you know, somewhere between like 13 and 16% higher than their non-union counterparts, right? All other things being equal. There is a significant gain in things like, you know, job security. They get paid sick days. They get more generous family leave policies, for instance. You know, it matters a lot when you're in a really tough, intense profession like home health care, when you're basically might be on call like 24/7, right, to have those days off. And of course, if you're a healthcare worker, you don't want to go to work sick, right? So having paid leave time is really important. You know, having things like pregnancy leave, right? Those are all things that are vital to working women, and they're especially rare for women who are doing low wage service work in the care industries like these women. I mean, the gulf is even greater when you're looking at home health care, because this is where benefits like that really matter. Because if you look at a lot of home health aides across the country that are, you know, working for private agencies or they're just independent contractors, you know, they might be even in a worse situation than, like, you know, domestic workers who may not have like the same kind of medical responsibilities, right? Because for a very long time, they were specifically carved out of federal labor protections. So under the Fair Labor Standards Act, it wasn't until recently that they even qualified for things like overtime, right? Recently, the Obama administration changed that rule, but it was only because activists were very active in pushing for it. But overall, I mean, unionization, absent, you know, things like dramatic increases in the minimum wage and, you know, big legislative changes, unions are a crucial backstop for a lot of women, and they are often their only representative. I mean, think about it. If you're basically laboring in someone's private home all day, I mean, it's just you and, like, basically the person who's supervising you, right? The patient you're caring for. There's no one else there to represent you. There's no shop floor, right? You know, rules are hard to enforce. And when you have a union behind you, then you have some measure of accountability. And yeah, like you said, I mean, there's a way, there's an institutionalization of your profession.
And what is being done? I mean, you know, it's interesting because I think and we've spent a decent amount of time talking in the past in this program to representatives of teacher unions, particularly ones like in Chicago and Massachusetts, where they're starting to perceive they're starting to follow a more of a social justice unionism model as opposed to like a business unionism model. And it seems to me that in this profession, not unlike the teaching profession, that there is an opportunity for the union to build relationships, strategic relationships with patient advocacy groups, because it's quite clear that not only do the caregivers benefit from being represented by a union and having all of the sort of standards and practices and mechanisms for accountability from their work perspective, but I would also imagine patients across the board too benefit, because now they get better home care providers.
That's right.
And so is there a move? Has the union indicated that there's going to be a move to try and build relationships with advocates for those home care patients?
Yeah, I mean, they've already done that in large part. In fact, I mean, when they were first fighting for a union in the first place, right? When during their first initial push for a union, they reached out a lot to communities. They went to the client community. They went to people with disabilities who were already receiving care, and they said, "Look, this is an arrangement that's going to benefit both of us, right?" And people who need this care at home, they understand how crucial it is to have like things like standards, right? Things like adequate rest time for the person who's, providing you with critical medical care, right? Often in the privacy of your own home when you don't have access to any other immediate medical help, right? There were groups, in the amicus briefs, you can actually find the voices of, the disability rights community saying that, look, don't take the union away. And what's ironic about that is that Alito tried to sort of drive a wedge through that argument, right, by saying, oh, it's, the clients are actually, the consumers of the care, they're actually their bosses, right? They tried to create that sort of, triangulate, between them, and what these consumers are saying is that, well, we actually favor unionization because what's good for our workers is good for the quality of our care. Look, their collective bargaining agreement includes things like training, right? I mean, that's critical, obviously, for people who are doing healthcare at home, and that wouldn't be guaranteed. There wouldn't be a baseline for the quality of that training or the quality of those professional services, without some form of collective agreement. And I think that's why the state also, which is the other, which is the technical employer of record here, the state was also in favor of the union. So you actually have this curious sort of arrangement where you have the bosses, so-called, who actually understand this is a critical public service these women are providing, and unionization is good for them and for us. And that's continued in their advocacy.
Do we have a sense of just how many workers? I mean, obviously, this is this case applies to whatever Sam Alito's favorite phrasing was, these partial public workers. I mean, how many of these exist in states to states? And are we already seeing sort of the implications on the other contracts that states may have with these groups of workers? In other words, the fallout from this, it obviously is larger than just Illinois.
Right. Well, I do want to stress that nothing in this ruling is going to change their fundamental right to form a union, right? That is protected. So in terms of just like their contracts and things like that, those exist, right? The issue now is how well is the union going to be able to support itself financially if you might have the dues payers population kind of eroded by this lack of the fair share protection. So it'll be a while before we see some of the financial fallout from this. But, right now we actually see more and more states coming on board. Started with California, Illinois, now Oregon, Washington, Massachusetts, Missouri have all, come out in favor of collective bargaining for their home care workforces. And, in a way, by making them all public employees, it gives them a little bit of an advantage in terms of just, all of a sudden the union is able to add 20,000-30,000 members, right? In a single election, or is able to increase, their collective bargaining representation by that much. It's going to be a rockier road ahead, but nothing changes the fundamental rights or the fundamental structure of collective bargaining. And I think that's going to be one of the things that unions are going to really have to sell, right, to workers.
Let me ask you this question too, and I haven't really been able to get an answer for it. I'm not sure that you'll be able to do this, but why wasn't this a determination that is left to the National Labor Relations Board under the National Labor Act. In other words, I know that in the context, I mean, every day, every week, I don't know what the National Labor Relations Board goes in and makes the determination of whether or not a group of people is qualifies to have a union. For instance, in New York, I know that there was a question. It actually garnered a little bit of attention because some MSNBC hosts were dragged into this. But there was a question as to whether or not one production entity owned by NBC, whether or not their writer-producer types, director types, were considered eligible to form a union, as to whether or not they were management or not management. In this instance, it's not exactly analogous, although it seems to me if the Supreme Court made their decision based upon whether or not they qualified as being public employees, as opposed to partial public employees, why wasn't that a determination for the National Labor Relations Board?
I think it has to do with, I mean, the thing is, like, they're deemed public employees simply by virtue of the fact that they are on the state payroll, right? I mean, they're in the employ of the state. What Alito did sort of creatively here is that he created, like, a subclass of public employees, which kind of deemed them quasi public workers. And so, I don't know exactly the sort of rationale behind the jurisprudence, but I imagine this is not really a determination for the National Labor Relations Board to determine, because I think they do things that are more just upholding existing law. And this was originally determined, the agency shop thing and fair share for public sector unions. Those are basically just, court precedents that apply to all public sector workers. And so how they're designated is kind of just, you know, depending on who their employer is. Mm. In terms of just like the right that they have to charge a service charge to all members of a collective bargaining unit, that was actually established in court precedent. And so it's left up to the Supreme Court to either uphold or overturn that precedent. But, anything deeper than that, you'll probably have to get a lawyer. So.
All right. Well, I have a bunch on my speed dial, but I'll work on it. But Michelle Chen, thank you so much for your time contributing to the Nation magazine, contributing editor in these times, and the co-host with Sarah Jaffe of the podcast Belabored. And where can people find that? On iTunes, or is that over at Dissent?
Yes, it's on iTunes, it's on Stitcher, and it's also on the Dissent website, so dissentmagazine.org.
All right, Michelle Chen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take let's just roll into, I want to talk about this, about Kansas. Now, I had mentioned this on the old 3-6 show. It's going to take me a week to get out of that mode, folks. And the story of Kansas is, every time I look at this, I remember being on the Dylan Radigan program, I guess, I don't know how many years ago that was now, 3 years ago. Maybe it was even four, when Radigan said, had posed a question to the panel, which was, we have a unique opportunity because we see Europe go all in on austerity policies, and we are ostensibly not engaged in that. I'm not sure I agreed with that assessment. It was a matter of degree. But nevertheless, he said, let's reconvene in a year to see how the European austerity policies are working, to see if that's the right course to take. And and in fact, the show had not been canceled before that year had passed. And I kept saying to Radigan on and off air, when are we going to do this? And I would say on air, I kept citing that, and we never did. Well, we had a similar dynamic with Kansas in 2012. In Kansas, the newly elected governor, and I think he was probably elected in 2010, actually, I believe it was. But in 2012, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback signed into law in Kansas a massive tax cut. It essentially dropped, it essentially got rid of all taxes on anyone who had set up any type of pass-through. In other words, an S-Corp or an LLC, something that you would form if you were creating a small business. It also dropped the tax rates on the wealthiest people in the state, slashing income taxes. Now, at the time in Kansas, they had a budget surplus, which I think had grown as a function of, well, increased tax revenues, imagine property taxes and whatnot, prior to him being elected. I think this was under a Democratic governor. Nevertheless, at the time, Kansas had a huge surplus. Well, now understand, too, that Brownback was advised throughout this process by Arthur Laffer. Arthur Laffer is the guy who came up with the Laffer curve. And anytime you hear the Republicans say, if we cut taxes, we will raise revenue, it is based on this concept that Laffer had, that when you tax people, you start to get diminishing returns on what their output will be, their productivity. Businesses will not seek to make as much money. Because if every dollar over, say, $500,000 or $250,000, and same with individuals, is taxed incrementally more, their incentive to make money will be diminished. And yes, it is masturbatory, as Michael is suggesting, non-verbally. So the theory was at the time, we're going to cut taxes. And we're going to see an explosion of revenues because new businesses will come here. The makers will make more money. And all this will lead to huge burgeoning economic activity. Well, after these tax cuts, the results are now in. Despite the fact that this bill was to create 23,000 new jobs by 2020, would lead more than 35,000 people to move to Kansas, the state general fund revenue is now down over $700 million. It is a huge chunk of the state's $6 billion budget. There have been extensive cuts to education. The state's bond rating has now been dropped by Moody's. Kansas's job growth has lagged behind the rest of the country, especially in the years following the first round of Brownback's tax cuts. You haven't had this massive migration to Kansas. In fact, none of what was predicted for Kansas has happened except for the massive shortfall in their budget, and they are digging into that surplus. Their employment statistics with those of the six neighboring states have lagged. Colorado's jobs up 8.2%. It is now worse in Kansas in terms of job growth than it was following the recession, directly following it.
That's stunning.
Yes.
I mean, that is like, how far do you have to go out of your way to get that stat?
Yes, it is. It has been horrible for Kansas and hopefully equally horrible for Sam Brownback, as he is now is statistically, or at least in terms of the polls, starting to lose against his Democratic challenger. Now, one would imagine he's going to raise a lot of money from all the extra tax windfall that the one percenters have. He has boasted of 16,000 new small businesses that have been created, without mentioning the 18,000 that have closed. Unbelievable. And, of course, he is also not showing Kansas residents the full implications of what happens when you cut taxes for people in terms of revenues, because he's dipping into the surpluses to fund a lot of the stuff, except, of course, education. Understand, too, the difference with a state versus a country is that the state does not issue their own currency. And in Kansas, you have to balance the budget. This is only going to get worse as this law continues to cut taxes. But let this be for the country. There should be far more talk of this. Let this be a lesson for the country and for those libertarians and Tea Partiers and all of them who think that cutting taxes will suddenly spur economic growth and suddenly spur more tax revenue. Because all of the new businesses will mean that there's a bigger pie from which to drive revenues. This is silliness. Businesses hire and businesses expand when demand increases. Period. Period. And if you want to call the program as we head into the better half of the program, 646-257-3920 is the number where you can explain to me how this data is irrelevant and to all of your economic models say this shouldn't happen.
Have you ever managed
a Denny's?
Boom.
Boom. There it is, folks. I have not. I want to talk more. We're going to have a guest on about what's this humanitarian crisis that is happening with these children. But there's an amazing story in the New York Times today where a reporter has actually gone down to, I believe she went down to El Salvador. And I believe it was a she. Yes, Sonia Nazario. And the piece, The Children of the Drug Wars, the piece really makes it clear why what is happening with these children is not an immigration crisis. It is a refugee or humanitarian crisis. Things have just gotten horrible in Central America. I mean, just devastatingly violent for children in particular. And the idea that the president would speed up the process to deport these children simply because there's some political, you see some political efficacy in terms of immigration is reprehensible. It's reprehensible. Studies show anywhere between 40 and 60% of these children would qualify for refugee status if the process works as it's supposed to be. There is something like a 275,000 case backlog to be handled by less than 300 immigration judges. You do the math here. We should also be providing counsel to all of these children, legal counsel, because you have a four times more of a chance of getting asylum status if you're represented by a lawyer for obvious reasons. For obvious reasons. You have children fearing for their lives. even the process, and I would imagine from the perspective of these children, the backlogs in hearing their cases, if they have to stay in so-called detention centers or in foster care or anything for a year or year and a half, as opposed to heading back to El Salvador or Honduras, I'm sure it is there. It is almost a dream come true. When you hear the level of violence that these kids are subjected to, the fear that they are living in, you begin to understand why they have made this journey and why seeing immigration officers or border patrol officers that they willingly handed themselves over to must have been a relief. It really is stunning. Maybe I'll read from this piece in the better half. But this is a humanitarian crisis, and the president should go down to the border and should engage in a photo op. And it should be with these children. And he should sit there with a translator and have some of these children tell them what they are dealing with so that the rest of the country can absorb this. And then make these thugs, like we saw out in front of that bus in Marietta, justify themselves. I saw a report also from the UN refugee, I'm not sure exactly what agency it is, and they interviewed 400 some odd children. And apparently out of that, literally 1%, four of them, and I guess that's, 1%, said that they were coming because they understood the immigration laws in this country would allow them to stay. The rest were talking about the tremendous amount of violence that they were dealing with. All right, let's take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. If you want to be a part of this program, you can IM me. Tomorrow on the program, we will have Glenn Greenwald on. We will be doing it. If you're listening live, we're going to have him. We're going to break format a little bit because of scheduling reasons. The interview will actually start at closer to 1. And we will do an extended member show for the first hour. And perhaps maybe we'll run an interview from last week as well. All right, we're going to take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can Skype at Majority Live. We'll be back.
I have our little Ramones tribute ready. Can we play it to go out to the better
house? Let's do.